"Would such a creature appeal to you?" Alan said. "You can be so ghastly."
"I feel sorry for Persephone, because even when she's back with the living, people are afraid of her because of where she's been," Emma said. "And even when she's with her mother, she's not really happy, because she knows she'll have to go back underground." She grinned at Adora and jabbed a big bite of ham into her mouth, then crowed, "Gayla, I need sugar!" Emma yelled at the door. "Use the bell, Emma," my mother said. She wasn't eating either. Gayla came in with a bowl of sugar, sprinkled a big spoonful over Emma's ham and sliced tomatoes.
"Let me," Emma whined.
"Let Gayla," my mother said. "You put too much on."
"Will you be sad when John's dead, Camille?" Emma said, sucking on a slice of ham. "Would you be more sad if John died or I did?"
"I don't want anyone to die," I said. "I think Windgap has had too much death as it is."
"Hear, hear," Alan said, oddly festive.
"Certain people should die. John should die," Emma continued. "Even if he didn't kill them, he still should die. He's ruined now that his sister is dead."
"By that same logic, I should die, because my sister is dead and I'm ruined," I said. Chewed another kernel. Emma studied me.
"Maybe. But I like you, so I hope not. What do you think?" She turned to Adora.
It occurred to me she never addressed her directly. No mother or mama or even Adora. As if Emma didn't know her name but was trying not to be obvious about it.
"Marion died a long, long time ago, and I think maybe we should have all ended with her," my mother said wearily.
Then suddenly bright.
"But we didn't. And we just keep moving on, don't we?"
Ringing of bell, gathering of plates, Gayla circling the table like a decrepit wolf. Bowls of blood-orange sorbet for dessert. My mother disappearing discreetly into the pantry and surfacing with two slender crystal vials and her wet pink eyes. My stomach lurched.
"Camille and I will have drinks in my bedroom," she said to the others, fixing her hair in the sideboard mirror.
She was dressed for it, I realized, already in her nightgown. Just as I had as a child when I was summoned to her, I trailed her up the stairs. And then I was inside her room where I'd always wanted to be. That massive bed, pillows sprouting off it like barnacles, the full-length mirror embedded in the wall, and the famous ivory floor that made everything glow as if we were in a snowy, moonlit landscape. She tossed the pillows to the floor, pulled back the covers and motioned for me to sit in bed, then got in next to me. All those months after Marion died, when she kept to her room and refused me, I wouldn't have dared to imagine myself curled up in bed with my mother. Now here I was, more than 15 years too late. She ran her fingers through my hair and handed me my drink. A sniff. Smelled like brown apples. I held it stiffly, but didn't sip.
"When I was a little girl, my mother took me into the North Woods and left me," Adora said. She didn't seem angry or upset. Indifferent. Almost bored. She didn't explain why. She didn't say a word to me, in fact. Just told me to get in the car. I was barefoot. When we got there, she took me by the hand and very efficiently pulled me along the trail, then off the trail, then dropped my hand and told me not to follow her. I was 8. Just a small thing. My feet were ripped into strips by the time I got home, and she just looked up at me from the evening paper and went to her room. This room.
Why are you telling me this?
When a child knows that young that her mother doesn't care for her, bad things happen.
Believe me, I know what that feels like, I said. Her hands were still running through my hair, one finger toying with my bare circle of scalp.
I wanted to love you, Camille, but you were so hard. Marion, she was so easy.
Enough, Mama, I said.
No, not enough. Let me take care of you, Camille. Just once, need me. Let it end. Let it all end. Let's do it then, I said.
I swallowed the drink in a belt, peeled her hands from my head, and willed my voice to be steady.
I needed you all along, Mama. In a real way. Not a need you created so you could turn it on and off. And I can't ever forgive you for Marion. She was a baby.
She'll always be my baby, my mother said.
Chapter 16. I fell asleep without the fan on, woke up with the sheets stuck to me. My own sweat and urine. Teeth chattering and my heartbeat thumping behind my eyeballs. I grabbed the trash can beside my bed and threw up. Hot liquid, with four kernels of corn bobbing on top. My mother was in my room before I pulled myself back onto the bed. I pictured her sitting in the hall chair next to the photo of Marion, darning socks while she waited for me to sicken.
Come on, baby. Into the bathtub with you, she murmured.
She pulled my shirt over my head, my pajama bottoms down. I could see her eyes on my neck, breasts, hips, legs for a sharp blue second. I vomited again as I got into the tub, my mother holding my hand for balance. More hot liquid down my front and onto the porcelain. Adora snapped a towel from the rack, poured rubbing alcohol into it, wiped me down with the objectivity of a window cleaner. I sat in the bathtub as she poured glasses of cold water over my head to bring the fever down, fed me two more pills and another glass of milk the color of weak sky. I took it all with the same bitter vengeance that fueled me on two-day benders. I'm not down yet. What else you got? I wanted it to be vicious. I owed Marion that much. Vomiting into the tub, draining the tub, refilling, draining. Ice packs on my shoulders, between my legs. Heat packs on my forehead, my knees. Tweezers into the wound on my ankle, rubbing alcohol poured after. Water flushing pink. Vanish, vanish, vanish. Pleading from my neck. Adora's lashes were plucked clean, the left eye dribbling plump tears, her upper lip continually bathed with her tongue. As I was losing consciousness, a thought. I am being cared for. My mother is in a sweat mothering me. Flattering. No one else would do this for me. Marion. I'm jealous of Marion. I was floating in a half-full bath of lukewarm water when I woke again to screams. Weak and steaming, I pulled myself out of the bath, wrapped a thin cotton robe around me, my mother's high screams jangling in my ears, and opened the door just as Richard busted in. Camille, are you okay?
My mother's wails, wild and ragged, cutting the air behind him. Then his mouth fell open. He tilted my head to one side, looked at the cuts on my neck, pulled open my robe and flinched.
Jesus Christ!
A psychic wobbling. He teetered between laughter and fear. What's wrong with my mother?
What's wrong with you?
You're a cutter?
I cut words, I muttered, as if it made a difference.
Words. I can see that.
Why is my mother screaming? I felt woozy, sat down on the floor, hard.
Camille, are you sick?
I nodded. Did you find something? Vickery and several officers tumbled past my room. My mother staggered by a few seconds later, her hands wrapped in her hair, screaming at them to get out, to have respect, to know they'll be very sorry.
Not yet. How sick are you?
He felt my forehead, tied my robe shut, refused to look at my face anymore. I shrugged like a sulking child.
Everyone has to leave the house, Camille. Put on some clothes and I'll get you to the doctor's.
Yes. You need your evidence. I hope I have enough poison left in me.
By evening, the following items were removed from my mother's panty drawer. 8 vials of anti-malarial pills with overseas labels, big blue tablets that had been discontinued due to their tendency to induce fever and blurred vision. Traces of the drug were found in my toxicology tests. 72 tablets of industrial-grade laxative, used primarily for loosening the bowels of farm animals, traces of which were found in my toxicology tests. 3 dozen anti-seizure tablets, the misuse of which can cause dizziness and nausea, traces of which were found in my toxicology tests. 3 bottles of Ipecac syrup, used to induce vomiting in case of poisoning, traces of which were found in my toxicology tests. 161 horse tranquilizers, traces of which were found in my toxicology tests. A nurse's kit containing dozens of loose pills, vials, and syringes, none of which Adora had any use for. Any good use for. From my mother's hat box, a flowered diary, which would be entered as a court document, containing passages such as the following. September 14th, 1982. I've decided today to stop caring for Camille and focus on Marion. Camille has never become a good patient. Being sick only makes her angry and spiteful. She doesn't like me to touch her. I've never heard of such a thing. She has joyous spite. I hate her. Marion is such a doll when she's ill. She dotes on me terribly and wants me with her all the time. I love wiping away her tears. March 23rd, 1985. Marion had to go to Woodbury again, trouble breathing since the morning and sick to her stomach. I wore my yellow St. John suit, but ultimately didn't feel good about it. I worry with my blonde hair I looked washed out, or like a walking pineapple. Dr. Jameson is very masterful and kind, interested in Marion, but not a busybody. He seems quite impressed with me. Said that I was an angel and that every child should have a mother like me. We had a bit of a flirtation, despite the wedding rings. The nurses are somewhat troubling, probably jealous. We'll have to really dote next visit. Surgery seems likely. Might have Gala make her mincemeat. Nurses love little treats for their break area. Big green ribbon around the jar, maybe. I need to get my hair done before the next emergency. Hope Dr. Jameson, Rick, is on call. May 10th, 1988. Marion is dead. I couldn't stop. I've lost 12 pounds and am skin and bones. Everyone's been incredibly kind. People can be so wonderful. The most important piece of evidence was discovered under the cushion of the yellow brocade love seat in Adora's room. A stained pair of pliers, small and feminine. DNA tests matched trace blood on the tool to Anne Nash and Natalie Keene.
The teeth were not found in my mother's home. I had images for weeks after of where they might have gone. I saw a baby blue convertible driving, top up as always, a woman's hand jutting out the window, a spray of teeth into the roadside thicket near the path into the north woods, a set of delicate slippers getting muddied at the edge of Falls Creek, teeth plopping like pebbles into the water, a pink nightgown floating through Adora's rose garden, hands digging, teeth buried like tiny bones. The teeth were not found in any of these places. I had the police check. Chapter 17. On May 28th, Adora Krellen was arrested for the murders of Anne Nash, Natalie Keene, and Marion Krellen. Alan immediately paid the punishing bail sum so she could await trial in the comfort of her home. Considering the situation, the court thought it best for me to take custody of my half-sister. 2 days later, I drove north, back to Chicago, with Emma beside me. She exhausted me. Emma was wildly needy and afire with anxiety. Took to pacing like a caged wildcat as she fired angry questions at me. Why is everything so loud? How can we live in such a tiny place? Isn't it dangerous outside? And demanded assurance of my love. She was burning off all that extra energy from not being bedridden several times a month. By August, she was obsessed with female killers. Lucretia Borgia, Lizzie Borden, a woman in Florida who drowned her 3 daughters after a nervous breakdown. "I think they're special," Emma said defiantly. Trying to find a way to forgive her mother, her child therapist said. Emma saw the woman twice, then literally lay on the floor and screamed when I tried to take her for a third visit. Instead, she worked on her Adora dollhouse most hours of the day. Her way of dealing with the ugly things that happened there, her therapist said when I phoned. "Seems like she should smash the thing then," I answered. Emma slapped me in the face when I brought home the wrong color of blue cloth for Adora's dollhouse bed. She spat on the floor when I refused to pay $60 for a toy sofa made of real walnut. I tried hug therapy, a ridiculous program that instructed I clutch Emma to me and repeat, "I love you, I love you, I love you," as she tried to wriggle away. 4 times she broke free and called me a bitch, slammed her door. 5th time, we both started laughing. Alan loosened some cash to enroll Emma at the Bell School, $22,000 a year, not counting books and supplies, just 9 blocks away. She made quick friends, a little circle of pretty girls who learned to yearn for all things Missouri. The one I really liked was a girl named Lily Burke. She was as bright as Emma, with a sunnier outlook. She had a spray of freckles, oversized front teeth, and hair the color of chocolate, which Emma pointed out was the exact shade of the rug in my old bedroom. I liked her anyway. She became a fixture at the apartment, helping me cook dinner, asking me questions about homework, telling stories about boys. Emma got progressively quieter with each of Lily's visits. By October, she'd shut her door pointedly when Lily came by. One night, I woke to find Emma standing over my bed.
"You like Lily better than me," she whispered.
She was feverish, her nightgown clinging to her sweaty body, her teeth chattering. I guided her into the bathroom, sat her down on the toilet, wet a washcloth under the cool, metallic water of the sink, wiped her brow. Then we stared at each other. Slate blue eyes just like Adora's, blank, like a winter pond. I poured 2 aspirin into my palm, put them back in the bottle, poured them back onto my palm. 1 or 2 pills. So easy to give. Would I want to give another and another? would I like taking care of a sick little girl? A rustle of recognition when she looked up at me, shaky and sick. Mother's here. I gave Emma 2 aspirin. The smell made my mouth water. I poured the rest down the drain.
Now you have to put me in the bathtub and wash me, she whined.
I pulled her nightgown over her head. Her nakedness was stunning. Sticky little girl's legs. A jagged round scar on her hip like half a bottle cap. The slightest down in a wilted thatch between her legs. Full, voluptuous breasts. 13. She got into the bathtub and pulled her legs to her chin.
You need to rub alcohol on me, she whimpered.
No, Emma. Just relax. Emma's face turned pink, and she began crying.
That's how she does it, she whispered.
The tears turned into sobs, then a mournful howl. We're not going to do it like she does it anymore, I said. On October 12th, Lily Burke disappeared on her way home from school. 4 hours later, her body was found propped tidily next to a dumpster 3 blocks from our apartment. Only 6 of her teeth had been pulled, the oversized front 2 and 4 on the bottom. I phoned Wind Gap and waited on hold 12 minutes until police confirmed my mother was in her home. I found it first. I let the police discover it. But I found it first. As Emma trailed me like an angry dog, I tore through the apartment, upending seat cushions, rummaging through drawers. What have you done, Emma? By the time I got to her room, she was calm, smug. I sifted through her panties, dumped out her wish chest, turned over her mattress. I went through her desk and uncovered only pencils, stickers, and a cup that stank of bleach. I swept out the contents of the dollhouse room by room, smashing my little 4-poster bed, Emma's day bed, the lemon-yellow love seat. Once I'd flung out my mother's big brass canopy and destroyed her vanity table, either Emma or I screamed. Maybe both of us did. The floor of my mother's room. The beautiful ivory tiles. Made of human teeth. 56 tiny teeth, cleaned and bleached and shining from the floor. Others were implicated in the Wind Gap child murders. In exchange for lighter sentences in a psychiatric hospital, the 3 blondes admitted to helping Emma kill Anne and Natalie. They'd zipped out in Adora's golf cart and idled near Anne's home, talked her into coming for a ride. My mother wants to say hi. The girls putted to the North Woods, pretended they'd have a tea party of sorts. They prettied Anne up, played with her a bit, then after a few hours got bored. They started marching Anne to the creek. The little girl, sensing an ill wind, had tried to run away, but Emma chased her down and tackled her, hit her with a rock, got bitten. I saw the wound on her hip, but had failed to realize what that jagged half-moon meant. The 3 blondes held Anne down while Emma strangled her with a clothesline she'd stolen from a neighbor's tool shed. It took an hour to calm Jodes down and another hour for Emma to pull the teeth, Jodes crying the whole time. Then the 4 girls carried the body to the water and dumped it, zipped back over to Kelsey's home, cleaned up in the back carriage house, and watched a movie. No one could agree what it was. They all remembered they ate cantaloupe and drank white wine from Sprite bottles, in case Kelsey's mom peeked in. James Capisi wasn't lying about that ghostly woman. Emma had stolen one of our pristine white sheets and fashioned it into a Grecian dress, tied up her light blonde hair, and powdered herself until she glowed. She was Artemis, the blood huntress. Natalie had been bewildered at first when Emma had whispered into her ear, "It's a game. Come with me. We'll play." She spirited Natalie through the woods, back again to Kelsey's carriage house, where they held her a full 48 hours, tending to her, shaving her legs, dressing her up, and feeding her in shifts as they enjoyed the increasing outcry. Just after midnight on the 14th, the friends held her down while Emma strangled her. Again she pulled the teeth herself. Children's teeth, it turns out, aren't too hard to remove if you put real weight on the pliers, and if you don't care how they end up looking. Flash of Emma's dollhouse floor, with its mosaic of jagged, broken teeth, some mere splinters. The girls putt-putted in Adora's golf cart to the back side of Main Street at 4 in the morning. The aperture between the hardware store and beauty parlor was just wide enough to allow Emma and Kelsey to carry Natalie by hands and feet, single file, to the other side, where they propped her up, waited for the discovery. Again, Jodes cried. The girls later discussed killing her, worried she might crumble. The idea was almost in action when my mother was arrested. Emma killed Lily all by herself, hit her on the back of the head with a stone, then strangled her with bare hands, plucked the 6 teeth, and cut her hair. All down an alley behind that dumpster where she'd left the body. She'd brought the rock, pliers, and scissors to school in the hot pink backpack I'd bought for her. Lily Burke's chocolate-colored hair, Emma braided into a rug for my room in her dollhouse. Epilogue. Adora was found guilty of murder in the first degree for what she did to Marion. Her lawyer is already preparing the appeal, which is enthusiastically chronicled by the group that runs my mother's website, freeadora.org. Alan shut down the Wind Gap house and took an apartment near her prison in Vandalia, Missouri. He writes letters to her on days he can't visit. Quickie paperbacks were released about our murderous family. I was showered with book offers. Curry pushed me to take one and quickly backed off. Good for him. John wrote me a kind, pain-filled letter. He thought it was Emma all along, had moved into Meredith's place in part to keep watch, which explained the conversation I'd overheard between him and Emma, who'd enjoyed toying with his grief. Hurt as a form of flirtation, pain as intimacy, like my mother jabbing her tweezers into my wounds. As for my other Wind Gap romance, I never again heard from Richard. After the way he looked at my marked-up body, I knew I wouldn't. Emma will remain locked up until her 18th birthday, and likely longer. Visitors are allowed twice a month. I went once, sat with her in a cheerful playground area surrounded by barbed wire. Little girls in prison slacks and T-shirts hung on monkey bars and gym rings, under supervision of fat, angry female guards. 3 girls slipped jerkily down a warped slide, climbed the ladder, went down again, over and over, silently for the duration of my visit. Emma had cut her hair close to the scalp. It may have been an effort to look tougher, but instead gave her an otherworldly, elven aura. When I took her hand, it was wet with sweat. She pulled it away. I'd promised myself not to question her about the killings, to make the visit as light as possible. Instead, it came out almost immediately, the questions. Why the teeth? Why these girls who were so bright and interesting? How could they have offended her? How could she do it? The last line came out chidingly, as if I was lecturing her on having a party when I wasn't home. Emma stared bitterly at the 3 girls on the slide and said she hated everyone here. All the girls were crazy or stupid. She hated having to do laundry and touch people's stuff. Then she went silent for a minute, and I thought she was simply going to ignore my question.
I was friends with them for a while,
she said finally, talking into her chest.
We had fun running around in the woods. We were wild. We'd hurt things together. We killed a cat once. But then she...
As always, Adora's name went unsaid, got all interested in them.
I could never have anything to myself. They weren't my secrets anymore. They were always coming by the house. They started asking me questions about being sick. They were going to ruin everything. She didn't even realize it.
Emma rubbed her shorn hair harshly.
And why did Anne have to bite her? I couldn't stop thinking about it. Why Anne could bite her, and I couldn't.
She refused to say more, answered only in sighs and coughs. As for the teeth, she took the teeth only because she needed them. The dollhouse had to be perfect, just like everything else Emma loved. I think there is more. Anne and Natalie died because Adora paid attention to them. Emma could only view it as a raw deal. Emma, who had allowed my mother to sicken her for so long. Sometimes when you let people do things to you, you're really doing it to them. Emma controlled Adora by letting Adora sicken her. In return, she demanded uncontested love and loyalty. No other little girls allowed. For the same reasons, she murdered Lily Burke. Because, Emma suspected, I liked her better. You can come up with 4,000 other guesses, of course, about why Emma did it. In the end, the fact remains. Emma enjoyed hurting.
I like violence, she'd shrieked at me.
I blame my mother. A child weaned on poison considers harm a comfort. The day of Emma's arrest, the day it finally completely unraveled, Curry and Eileen parked themselves on my couch like concerned salt and pepper shakers. I slipped a knife up my sleeve, and in the bathroom, I stripped off my shirt and dug it deep into the perfect circle on my back, ground it back and forth until the skin was shredded in scribbly cuts. Curry broke in just before I went for my face. Curry and Eileen packed my things and took me to their home, where I have a bed and some space in what was once a basement rec room. All sharp objects have been locked up, but I haven't tried too hard to get at them. I am learning to be cared for. I am learning to be parented. I've returned to my childhood, the scene of the crime. Eileen and Curry wake me in the mornings and put me to bed with kisses, or in Curry's case, a gentle chuck under the chin. I drink nothing stronger than the grape soda Curry favors. Eileen runs my bath and sometimes brushes my hair. It doesn't give me chills, and we consider this a good sign. It is almost May 12th, 1 year exactly from my return to Wind Gap. The date also happens to be Mother's Day this year. Clever. Sometimes I think about that night caring for Emma, and how good I was at soothing her and calming her. I have dreams of washing Emma and drying her brow. I wake with my stomach turning and a sweaty upper lip. Was I good at caring for Emma because of kindness? Or did I like caring for Emma because I have Adora's sickness? I waver between the two, especially at night, when my skin begins to pulse. Lately, I've been leaning toward kindness.
This is Anne-Marie Lee. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn. This program was directed by Kelly Gilday. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright, 2006, by Gillian Flynn. Production copyright, 2006, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.